Now, last week, for those that were with us, we began to look at the subject of evolution. And as we look at this subject, you know, it is not designed to turn us all into biology students, but it is rather designed to kind of help the average Christian speak to the average atheist who believes that we came into being through the process of evolution of billions and billions of years. This study is also designed, of course, to help us to answer some of the questions that especially our younger ones face as they go through school and are sometimes exposed to teachers who espouse evolution really as their religion and belittle those that believe in any kind of creation religion. And we did see last week that evolution really is almost like a religion because it is something that is based upon faith. Faith in that which has never been seen. Faith in that something could come from nothing and that nothing could become something because it desired to be something other than the nothing. Right? Something that happened in small steps over billions of years. And as I said last week, they often use phrases like evolution wanted to do this or evolution pushed for this. It's almost as if evolution has some kind of universal conscious desire towards becoming something better. It is indeed faith, and it certainly is ironic to me that they would demean Christians for faith in a creating God, considering that to be an archaic notion when they themselves don't have a primordial leg to stand on when you consider how did all of this stuff get started. We learned last week that this is well known, this not having a mechanism to start, this is well known, of course, to evolutionary biologists. And it causes them not only to debate seriously how these things could happen and to speculate these things, but we looked at last week how some of the leading architectures of modern-day evolutionary thought believe that perhaps life was seeded here by alien civilizations that had somehow had their own advanced Darwinian evolution and become to this higher state and decided to seed the earth with a single cell that would then grow into all that life is today. Kind of funny, you know, considering, you know, they didn't think about seeding the earth with them or some other thing, just a single cell. I like science fiction, but that's actually a better script than most Star Trek episodes. Now, turn with me, if you would, to the book of Romans for a moment. Romans in chapter 1, verse number 20. Romans chapter 1, verse number 20. Says, for the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Because that when they knew God, they glorified him not as God, neither were thankful, but became vain in their imaginations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools, and changed the glory of the uncorruptible God into an image made like a corruptible man, into birds, into four-footed beasts, and creeping things. Wherefore God also gave them up to uncleanness through the lust of their own hearts, to dishonor their own bodies between themselves, who changed the truth of God into a lie, and worshipped and served the creature more than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. These verses declare for us that the earth and all that is in it, the stars in the sky, all of creation, indeed points to the world that there must be a creator God. People may not look at creation and know about sin and salvation. People may not look at creation and know a thing about Jesus. But the world is a manifestation that there is a creator God. And man once knew that God, but chose to become vain in their thinking, began to turn the creation itself into gods. What do I mean by that? I mean they made gods out of things like snakes, cows, crocodiles, all kinds of things they turned into their gods. And folks, that is what evolution really is. It is a celebration of life form after life form until you get to the greatest life form that they consider, which is the human. In the end, that is the creature that they worship. They have professed themselves to become wise, but in these things they have become fools, worshiping and serving the creature rather than the Creator. So last week we looked at the first refutation of evolution, and we did so by looking at the laws of probability. We looked at the number that has been calculated to show that there is no chance of something happening within the known universe. And we looked at the chances that all of these random processes could be carried out at one time to create one living cell, and we saw that the chances of those things taking place far exceeded the laws of probability. Now, immediately when I got done, Austin played the devil's advocate and showed me an article written by a biologist that said that as Christians, this was like the final line, as Christians, we need to stay out of the back of the envelope probability calculations and leave the calculations to the experts, and that given enough time and a lot more smaller probable steps, that anything was possible. Again, I remind you of the quote from the biochemist at Cambridge and MIT that I told you last week, that who concluded that the chances of a living cell forming from non-living material was equal to finding one particular atom, something you cannot see, in the entire universe. That was published in the Journal of Molecular Biology, and I'm pretty sure that they didn't use back-of-the-envelope calculations in coming up with their conclusions. But you see, that's what scientists often do. They belittle Christians as uneducated and incapable of determining such things for themselves. They believe that they are only wise enough, and even though that there is much disagreement between them on how all of these things take place. But I want you to understand the fact of the matter is it would not matter if I had a PhD in molecular biology and genetics. If I pointed out the flaws in their reasoning, they still would not believe because their conscience is seared. All of my reasoning will not change their minds. Only one can change their minds, and he is beyond reason. And there is only one way, and that is through the power of the Holy Spirit that changes the hearts and minds to Christ and his word. Now today we want to look at the subject, as we continue our thought process here, our second refutation of evolution. And today we want to look at the subject of if life can come from random mutations. Can life come from random mutations? The theory of evolution seems to rest on this principle that natural selection uses random mutations to produce new life forms over millions and billions of years. This is the mechanism that would produce a broadleaf tree and perhaps something like a pine needle from the same common ancestor. Now, I understand some of you all may not even know what a mutation is, so let's consider what the definition of a mutation is. A mutation is the changing of a structure of a gene resulting in a variant form that may be transmitted to subsequent generations caused by the alteration of single base units in DNA or the deletion, insertion, or rearrangement of larger sections of genes or chromosomes. That just cleared everything up, didn't it? I bet it did. So basically, any change in genetic structure that could be inheritable to future generations is a mutation. Now, as Christians, we do not refute mutations. Mutations do occur. They are a common fact of life. You have all known people in your life that have suffered certain diseases due to genetic mutations. A very common one that you might see is one called Down syndrome, which is a trisomy of chromosome 21. I believe that Gracie's stomach problem is due to a mutation of some genetic information. So the point I want you to understand is genetic mutations take place all the time, and often people suffer difficulties because of those mutations. Often. Not all mutations are harmful. Some, as a matter of fact, the majority are said to be neutral. That is, they really don't affect too much in life. They don't have a positive impact. They don't have a negative impact. But out of those that have a positive or negative impact, it is far more likely that a mutation of a gene or genetic structure chromosome will have a negative impact over a positive impact, the ratio being somewhere of 8 negative events to 2 positive events. Now, globally speaking, the world is growing at a rate right now where there are more mutations taking place in what we call the human genome than ever before. The evolutionists say that we haven't had enough time for the earth to purge out those that are bad and develop through natural selection those which are good. Population growth has to them, exceeded the time necessary for evolution and natural selection to take place. But again, getting back to our conversation, can mutations lead to new and distinct life forms? Because that is what needs to take place for the theory of evolution to stand. So we're going to break down evolution today into three different categories, and these are just for us to help us to understand. The first one that we're going to look at, we'll call type 1 evolution. Type 1 evolution, there is no additional genetic information being formed. Most of the time, this is genetic information that is lost between the parent and the child, where it can be just the expression of a gene has been turned off for so long it becomes useless in a population. An example to try to explain this evolution is this. If we had a population of mice, and we had black mice and we had white mice, and we put those mice on a white sandy beach somewhere in the Caribbean where we'd all rather be on this nice, cool morning, the black mice would be at a disadvantage because as they're out scurrying along the white sandy beaches, the bird of prey could come and pick up the black ones easier because they're easier to see. So eventually, over time, what happens is we have more white mice being born. Why? Because the black mice are disappearing, right? But some of the white mice will still continue to have those black fur traits, perhaps buried somewhere in their genetic structure, maybe being turned, what we call turned off or repressed because of environmental conditions. But let's say that a pelican comes along and picks up a bunch of white mice and then takes those mice to a black pebble beach. And now that we're on a black pebble beach, the white mice are now at a disadvantage, aren't they? Because now they can be seen. So what happens is because of environmental stresses, because the genetic code is really still hanging back there, we'll start to see some black mice being born. And the black mice will reproduce more because the white mice are being picked up more. So now we have a black population of mice. And if those black mice stay there long enough, eventually the genetics for that white mice, they'll just fade away. They'll be lost. Now, in that example, we have no new genetic information being created whatsoever. What we have is a decrease in genetic information or genetic information being expressed until the new environment favors the expression of the suppressed genes. Now, we could come up with a scenario about all kinds of creatures and characteristics from birds' beaks to moths' wings. But in all of those, the type of evolution that we're talking about in type 1 evolution is a reduction of the genetic code or expression of those traits. No new genetic information is acquired. That's important for you to remember. No new genetic information is acquired. A mouse is still a mouse. A finch is still a finch, and a moth is still a moth. The creature does not change one bit. Breeders use type 1 evolution all the time when they take certain characteristics of dogs and perhaps they want to breed a smaller dog, and they always get them tinier and tinier from big down to these little teacups to teapot or whatever. They get smaller and smaller all the time. They're using type 1 evolution because they're breeding out certain traits to get those dogs, or perhaps cats with certain fur colors and things like that, whatever they like. Scientists use type 1 evolution as well. One of the big ways that they use it is for the production of seeds. You've heard the word GMO before. I hope you've heard the word GMO. It stands for genetically modified organism. Now, what they do is they take those seeds and they irradiate them and towards certain chromosomes to try to destroy certain things within them to create basically certain characteristics. They want to see if certain characteristics will develop within those plants. A sturdier root growth, perhaps something that butterflies don't like to eat or certain bugs, not butterflies necessarily, certain bugs won't attack. It has, of course, affected the butterfly population. Whenever scientists, by the way, are looking for seeds to do this to, you know what they do? They go to parts of the world that are using seeds that have not been hybridized over the ages. They go to find the oldest seeds they can find, because they want to start with as much genetically unaltered information as possible and then work it down. So what we're dealing with, again, is the loss of genetic structure. But again, the dog is still a dog, and a piece of corn is still a piece of corn, even though you probably shouldn't eat it. Now, type 1 mutation or lack of expression never, ever, ever causes a leg to grow out of a worm. It never causes a lizard to lose its legs and become a snake. Type 1 evolution cannot create the changes necessary for Darwinian evolution, as it always starts with a larger genetic diversity and loses that diversity along the way. Now, let's look at type 2. Type 2 evolution. Type 2 evolution is the addition of genetic information from one organism to another organism. The realm of this taking place is typically in a virus or in a bacterial level. For instance, E. coli. You don't like that word necessarily. I understand people have negative thoughts about that word as soon as it's said, but E. coli is typically a normal bacteria found within your gut. There's nothing wrong with it being there. But There is a potentially lethal strain of E. coli that is often referred to as just 0157. And that lethal strain of E. coli came from a plasmid of another bacteria that was engulfed by this E. coli bacteria somewhere along the way. And because it took on that plasmid that had genetic information in it, it started using that genetic information to become this lethal strain. Now, what we must understand is that in type 2 evolution, again, no new genetic information is created. It is only exchanged. It is only transmitted from one organism to the next. And the end result, 100% of the time, is that it does not make a new organism. The E. coli is still E. coli. Salmonella is still Salmonella. The difference is we now have a new strain. For most organisms outside of the virus and bacteria level, this transfer of genetic material cannot take place. Most organisms have really what is considered an anti-evolution component in that they will not exchange genetic material. A human may seem very much genetic-wise like a chimp, but we can't mate with chimps and have offspring, or vice versa. It's true in the plant world as well. A rose cannot receive the pollen of a tulip. Won't do it any good. None at all. The instances in breeding very similar animals, like a horse and a donkey to get a mule, or the more exotic breeders who do things like a lion and a tiger to get a liger, result in sterile offspring, so that the genetic line stops with that. It cannot continue on. Now, so again, type 2 evolution cannot create a new species. You only get a change of what you already have. The third type of evolution, and the last we'll talk about as far as mutations go, and you're probably thinking, thank the Lord. This type of mutation is the creation of all new genetic information that creates something useful that has never been present before, like a worm that now has the genetic information to grow legs. Now, I want you to think about that genetic information just for a second. So if now we have a worm that somehow wants to crawl on legs, and there is this now huge addition of genetic information to get a leg. Think about what comes with a leg. You've got to have a skeletal structure of some type to support it, either an endoskeleton or an exoskeleton, right? You've got to have arteries. You've got to have veins. You've got to have muscles. You've got to have nerves. You've got to have capillaries. You got to have everything to make that leg work, genetically encoded in this new information to make it useful. Now, for type 1 and type 2 evolution, if you want to call it that, I gave you a couple of common examples of how that happened. I can't do that for type 3 because it has never, ever, ever been observed. Let me stress that. Type 3 evolution has never, ever been observed. Scientists don't even have a good explanation of how large quantities of new genetic information can be added to a cell. This is one of those things that they bicker about. They believe in evolution but can't explain how this information, this new genetic material, could somehow be created. But this type 3 evolution is what Darwinian evolution stands on. This is what's needed for it all to take place. Last week, we mentioned Richard Dawkins, who is at the forefront of the evolutionary studies. He wrote a 471-page book called The Greatest Show on Earth, The Evidence for Evolution, in which he planned to inexplicably show that evolution was a fact. And in his book, he gives only one example of type 3 evolution, which concerned a strain of E. coli developing the ability to use citrate. But the researchers who did the experiments readily reported that it was not type 3, but rather type 1 evolution of a trait that had been lost long ago and was now being expressed. So no type 3 has ever been observed. And again, we didn't have a development of a new species. We only had a development of a trait, even at that. And by the way, this isn't because scientists haven't tried to make this happen. They've certainly tried. They do it all the time. And they, of course, they do so on the simplest of levels with bacteria and viruses. They can make in a lab, they can make E. coli, a generation of E. coli in 30 minutes. In 30 minutes, they can produce a whole new generation of it. So over the last 50 years, tens and thousands of generations of these bacteria have been grown. And yet we see no type 3 evolution, no genesis of useful genetics. And folks, that's at the bacteria level. That's at the virus level, down to the cellular level. If it isn't observed there, doesn't it even seem more preposterous that when you look at the greater complexity of an organism like a dog or a cat, of this creation of new genetic material all of a sudden could take place? I mean, you're talking about small steps there. This is huge steps when you get to more complex creations. When we consider that the natural tendencies for mutations is actually to cause more harm than to help the survival of the organism by producing a positive effect, the mechanism of Darwinian evolution just does not make sense. 4 billion years isn't even long enough. Scientists believe that most of the type of macroevolution, that is, the big changes, the changes that would take a common ancestor of dogs to take dogs and coyotes and all these things, all the different branches, that most of those morphological changes and things like that that's taken place has happened within the last 600 million years. Comparing that to the fossil record that records the extinction of animals. We compare how many extinct animals that they've discovered. Within the 600 million time frame, it would mean that a new species would have had to emerge every 5 years. If mutations were leading to new organisms, we should still be observing it today. Certainly within the last 100 or even 50 years. So, in our refutation of evolution, principle 1 was probability. Refutation number 2 is mutations just can't produce new species. Mutations cannot produce the large quantities of useful genetic information that would be required to take one organism to the next. It has never been observed by a scientist, and certainly what has been observed is typically the decrease in genetic information rather than an increase. Now, we're going to look at one more refutation of evolution today, and we're going to conclude, but We're not going to get too far into it because we're going to pack up with it next time a little bit. We do have at least one more week ahead of us. But we're going to look at the fossil record for just a moment. The fossil record. What does the fossil record bear witness to? Does it stand in opposition, or does it stand as a witness to evolution? The first thing we need to consider is, what is a fossil? A fossil, again, is any remains, impression, or trace of a living thing of a former geological age, as a skeleton, footprint, etc. We know that animals can be entrapped in lava, but most fossils that we find upon the earth are formed in what's called sedimentary rock. All animals and plants don't make fossils. That's pretty obvious to us. Most things land on the ground and they die and they rot, dust to dust. For a fossil to form, we have to have a quick burial and the right conditions of pressure to create a mold of that organism in the developing rock have to take place. Sometimes if it's bone or wood, the minerals from the soil will come in and enter into it, and it will petrify it. So we get like a petrified wood or petrified bone. That's a fossil as well. Fossils can even be a wholly preserved animals. For instance, they have unearthed woolly mammoths trapped in ice. Some have been found with food in their mouth. So we know that what took place very quickly because they were just sitting there eating. Now, you might have heard the term fossil record before. That is where scientists look at the level of strata that is found within a geological column and the organisms that are found within that layer. Now, the presumed idea is that the animals at the bottom of the geological layer are older than the ones at the top. The age of the Earth at one time was calculated by the millions of individual layers within that strata of geological columns. But today, the geological scale puts the Earth again at 4.5 billion years old, and they do that by radiometric dating, which we may talk about next week as well. Most scientific books will cite the fossil record as support for evolution, but there are certainly some problems with that. For instance, again, fossils do not normally occur. You could bury your dog and 30 years later dig in that spot and you might find bones, but you're not probably going to find a fossil. A process for a plant to form fossils is even less likely because it decomposes even faster. What does occur, though, is fossils forming under sudden catastrophic events. Something being quickly buried under immense pressure, typically formed underwater. Sedimentary rock is typically formed underwater. We'll talk about that next time as we kind of look at the idea of the flood. But for now, know that the fossil record gives us a picture of death. Now, today when you look at the world, you look at the diversity of life that's on it. You look at the plants, the trees, you look at the animals, and you think about how many animals there are in the world, and certainly it just there's so many. But you know, when they look at the fossil record, there was even more. There was even more. We only have a glimpse of what's been here before. It's estimated by geologists that 98% of the life that has ever existed is dead, extinct, no longer here. That's a lot of organisms that we don't even know, that we don't know existed, most of us anyway. So the idea, though, is that we actually have less variety of life on the planet than has ever existed, according to the fossil record. Again, animals preserved because of catastrophic events. In examining all that fossil record, though, you know what they have not found? And this is why we're mentioning this today. The intermediates. The missing links, so to say. Evolution asserts that one organism evolves slowly into another. The fossil record is completely void of that recording. We don't find snakes with 20% wings. What use would 20% of a wing be anyway? Now, I'm going to go at least again one more week. We're going to talk about the fossil record a little bit more in comparison with the idea of a global flood. We may talk about radiometric dating a little bit with that because that's something some of you all probably want to know about. But I don't want to stay in this study too long. I told Heather last night, there's more important things in the Word of God to study than what we're looking at right now. But this is to give especially the younger ones a help as they go through these classes. And I hope it's been a help to you. So one more week at least, and then we're going to get right into the book of 1 Timothy. I'm getting excited for that.